There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Expat investment expert and author Andrew Hallam is back in town. He's the author of Millionaire Teacher and Millionaire Expat. He spends his time teaching expats how not to get sucked into dodgy investment products. And he's here with us in the studio. Andrew, it's lovely to see you again. How are you going?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the invite.
Before we have a look at where stock markets are at the moment and what that means for people looking to invest, the last time we spoke to you, you were in the first leg of a major road trip that you were on, heading down to Argentina. Where are you now? I mean, I know now you're in Dubai, but in terms of your road trip, where are you now?
I think we thought we'd be probably in Argentina by now, but we left British Columbia in October. So we bought a camperized van and we arrived into Mexico in December, and we're still in Mexico because Mexico is just fabulous.
Which part are you in?
We are in the Yucatan Peninsula. So we've left our van in a little place called Chetumal, and which is right on the Belize border.
And how are you taking your sort of trademark frugality to this trip? I mean, Malcolm was joking earlier about the lengths you went when you were younger to save, to have money to invest. How is that manifesting itself in this trip?
Well, the area we are in, the areas we've been traveling, are really low cost anyway. So it's not something we think about so much anymore. I think in the very beginning, we were very frugal. And now I don't think we think so much about frugality. We just happen to be in an area that is really cheap to live. So there's nothing expensive down there. There's nowhere to really blow your money anyway. But we're having a great time.
And the food is good, I bet.
The food is great. The people are great. The cultures are colorful. We love it.
Well, one of the reasons that we do talk to you, not so much about frugality, but more about investing, is because you retired early. I mean, traditional retirement from the day job, you're certainly still working, which allows you to do things like drive down to Argentina. And that's largely down to investing boringly, many people would say, in the stock market. You're the guy who advises the dull index funds, the sort of bond ratio portfolio, and doing it yourself. Let's look at where the markets are at the moment. US markets, extremely high. For a lot of people who aren't yet invested, I imagine that people will be thinking, I don't want to get in at this level. That's a really stupid level to buy in at.
One of the things about the markets, of course, is you have to look at how are you measuring that level. So there are two things. I'm not saying that the U.S. markets aren't high, but what many people don't recognize is they'll see a headline, it'll say U.S. stocks hit an all-time high. But that's what the stock market is supposed to do. Otherwise, we wouldn't make money in the markets over time. So if you look at, for me, for example, I'm 48 years old. And if we count 2018, in my 48 years of life, U.S. stock markets hit all-time highs during 34 calendar years. So it continues to hit highs. But what we need to do is, of course, measure that relative to business earnings. And even when we do that, the U.S. market is at an all-time high. There's a really good way of measuring it called a CAPE ratio. It's a cyclically adjusted price-to-earnings ratio, where we measure business profits relative to the levels of the market. And we've been here before at this level. We're at about 30 times earnings, and we've been at 30 times earnings before, and 1997 was the very last time we hit that level. And what's really fascinating is to look at, all right, in 1997, obviously people were saying, we're really high right now, things are frightening, what are we gonna do? But the cool thing is looking at what's happened since 1997, and I can address that if you like.
And Andrew, you've done very well on your own predictions, and people have bought into it. You believe that a lot of the financial advisors have been selling overpriced product to a lot of people who are on basic salaries, and that they're spending far too much in commissions and earnings for the IFA themselves, not for their own portfolio. And what you've just said is absolutely great. You know, index trackers, et cetera, in a bull run. And the bull run has been going on for, I mean, goodness knows how long now, 30 years or something, is it 29 years? It's been a long time. But that's likely to change over the next few years. How does your policy hold up in a bear market?
Well, I think the most important thing is to think, when you recognize the complete academic picture, ultimately, if you really are greedy and patient, and you must be patient to be able to accept the greatest returns. So let's just look at the global stock market index for an example. So if somebody had invested $10,000 in the global stock market index, and when I say that, it's represented by market capitalization. So 55% of the global stock market index is made up of U.S. stocks and the rest international stocks. So if somebody invested $10,000 in 1970 and they earned the rate of return of the market, that $10,000 then would have grown to, with no money added, $982,000 for a return of 10.03%. This includes the drop of 1973-74, which incidentally was bigger than the drop of 2008-2009.
Those are the time of the oil wars.
Exactly. And it includes the tech stock drop 2002-2003 when Bush went to war with Iraq. It includes the market crash we had 2008-2009. The thing to note, though, isn't to get carried away with individual year returns. So if you're worried about having your money drop during years where the market drops, you're not going to reap the biggest rewards. So investors need to think in terms of decades instead of in terms of years.
So to me, that would suggest that, look, if you're going all the way back to 1970 there, obviously you can't invest retroactively, retrospectively. So for anyone who's 40, 50, who's got 10, 15 years left to work with the prospect of a bear run, maybe they shouldn't take your advice on this. Maybe they haven't got long enough to benefit.
I think they do, because let's say you have somebody who has 10, 15 years left to work. And I think that's the question you're asking me, right? It's not how long you're working that counts. It's how long you're living that counts. Because even after you retire, you're not going to be selling everything, buying a yacht until the money's gone. So you're going to need that money to last as long as you do. So a 50-year-old, for example, could live until they're 85. Well, there's 35 years that their money's in the market. Yes, when they stop working, they'll be selling pieces of that to cover their cost of living. But ultimately, that money needs to continue to grow for them. So people need to think much longer term than what do we think the markets are going to do this month, this year.
That can be psychologically quite difficult to do, though, can't it? Particularly if you are just coming in and all the news reports that you hear are, you know, of trade wars and Brexit woes and the markets are going to fall off a cliff. And you would think, well, I'll just wait for them to... I mean, if you embrace the idea that you also expose of things getting cheaper isn't bad, it's a good time to buy, you just think, well, I'll just wait for the cliff.
And that's one of the things that really trips people up. It's the behavior. So, you know, when I've been on the show before, we've talked about investment costs. And investment costs are catastrophic. The more you pay in investment fees, the less money you make. But a bigger component, a more damaging component, is the idea of speculation, is waiting to get in, so being afraid to get in at a given time. My suggestion is not to wait to get in. Build a responsible, diversified portfolio of low-cost index funds that include a bond market component. Rebalance that portfolio once a year back to your original allocation, much like a college endowment fund would do. But we do know that when we try to speculate, it usually hurts us, even when the professionals do. Are you familiar with tactical asset allocation funds? That's an interesting case study to look at.
Talk some more? Mm-hmm.
All right. So a tactical asset allocation fund, it's like a mutual fund or a unit trust, and it's managed by a chartered financial analyst who buys and sells stocks, bonds on behalf of its investors. And so what they try to do is they try to predict. So they're looking at all of the things that you're looking at when you're asking me about trade wars, when you're looking at interest rates, when you're looking at political structure, when they're looking at corporate business earnings and corporate projections. And so what they do, these are professionals, that try to dance in and out of different asset classes to take advantage of speculative swings. And when we look at Morningstar's tactical asset allocation funds, they have 192 of them trading in the United States, where these people can invest anywhere they want. These managers can move their money on a daily basis, and they do. And if we look at their returns for those 182 tactical asset allocation funds, 88% of them over the last 5 years underperformed a simple 70% global stock index, 30% bond index. It's much the same if we look at hedge funds. Even when you remove the costs associated with a hedge fund. Now, a hedge fund manager can do whatever they want. They can short the market if they think the market's going to go down. And by shorting the market, when the market drops, obviously they're able to capitalize that. And in theory, their investors make really strong returns. So when we look at the HFRX indices database of hedge fund returns back to 2003, now we've had some pretty big bumps in the road since 2003. But when we look at their performance relative to something really simple, like a global stock index and a bond index, they've underperformed that portfolio on aggregate every single year.
Let's talk about some of the trends that are going on in the world at the moment and how they might influence the way we invest or what we can expect from our returns. Let's start by talking about the rise in retirement ages. We've been talking about countries recently around the world that are raising the age at which people retire, or indeed just countries in which people may have passed the retirement age but not be in a position to actually retire. How does that affect your investment plans?
I don't think it necessarily should, because then you're looking at a demographic component of trying to speculate. And the speculation is what really hammers people, right? So I think that I talk about your investment portfolio as a bar of soap. And the more you mess with it, the smaller it will get. And so the idea of just building a globally diversified portfolio and keeping these external factors completely out of the picture. If you want to retire somewhere where it's cheap, you look at what you can control. You can't forecast. Nobody can forecast. And so we have evidence on that in terms of where markets are headed. We have a firm called CXO Advisory that tracked 6,582 market forecasts between 2005 and 2012. So a lot happened during the markets there. We had the financial crisis during the market periods there. But at the same time, during that time period, they were right about as often as a fifth grade child or a 10-year-old kid would be. And so the whole thing of trying to guess where things are going to go is really difficult. If you don't have a lot of money and you really don't have a lot and you want to be retiring, don't mess with your portfolio or alter your portfolio based on what you see economically or through trends, but retire in a low-cost destination.
It's quite an important question, this, because the Schroders Global Investment Study has just come out. They interviewed 22,000 people from 30 countries, including the UAE. And they said that retirees globally, on average, receive about 61% of their final salary annually, which doesn't sound too bad to me. Even living in your home country, you're not going to have to flee. Mm. Is that your sort of expectation around that 60% mark? Is that what you think people should have as an annual income?
I think it's all dependent, but one of the things that we all need to recognize and not to get too worried about is that when we're retired, we're no longer having the same kinds of expenses. So that's one thing that's nice. Obviously, we're hoping that the children are out of the picture in terms of they're not on that umbilical cord any longer.
But then surely medical comes along and replaces that as an expense.
It certainly can. So it's so dependent, Malcolm, on where you choose where you're choosing to retire. So that's such a dependent issue. But if you're looking at the vehicle that you're driving to work and the clothes that you're driving and the saving for retirement, that's all gone when you're actually retired. And the great thing about expats is we see so much of the world and we can have so many choices. So somebody could live what you are, let's say something like 60% of your income here in Dubai. You could be living on probably 40% of your Dubai-based income in a place like Mexico, a place like Ecuador or Thailand, and there's some fantastic expat locations for us.
Well, you're a Mexican. You're Mexican.
I'm most Mexican, absolutely.
You're an American driving to Argentina. You've stopped off in Mexico for
I'm
a short
American,
break, but you've been there all year.
He's a Canadian.
You're Canadian. North of the border, and you've stopped off in Mexico. You obviously like it there, and the money goes, I guess, a lot further than it does in Canada. So is that what we all have to do? Just be a little bit more flexible about where we return. If we can't afford to live in our home country, you find somewhere. How easy is that to do now?
I think it's very easy. There was a really good book that was published by John Wiley and Sons. I think it was 2014, and it was How to Retire on a Budget. And this is what it was called. It was called, now that the title is escaping me, International Living's Guide to Retiring Overseas on a Budget, How to Live Well on $25,000 a Year or Less. And if you have no idea, I strongly recommend you pick up that book. It goes through country by country, the medical systems, safety, the types of social environments you can expect as an expatriate, what the government will do for you in each of these locations. So, for example, in Panama, you've got the medical situation, which is phenomenal. And there are all sorts of really cool perks in Panama.
They give sort of pension discounts, don't they, on everything from buses to restaurants. And you don't even have to be old. You just have to prove that you've got a certain amount of money that you can live on.
Correct. Fabulous resource.
Is that $25,000 figure you mentioned there, is that considered the breadline?
Oh, I don't know. It's all dependent on
where you go, but
where what sort of lifestyle that you're into. I mean, you could be spending $70,000-$80,000 a year in a place like Mexico and living like royalty, or you could be living on significantly less. So, of course, it's entirely up to the person.
That Schroeder study also said that people in the UAE save about 14% per annum of their salary, which is a little bit above the international standard. So not bad in that aspect. So I guess it's what you do with it, really. That's the key
exactly.
thing.
Yeah. If invested properly, that 14% could go a long way.
We are seeing a lot more schemes now to take advantage of your assets, things like Airbnb. I know people who are considering buying property who probably wouldn't have before because they're expats, wouldn't be in it all the time, and they now have an option for short-term lets. Do you think that makes property more attractive as an investment?
Oh, it certainly could, because it's allowed you to take an asset that you have and create some kind of cash flow from that. So some of the exciting things we've seen with Airbnb is that people will also, when they are letting out an apartment, they'll sometimes bring in an actual experience as well. So they'll take you around the town. So you could take somebody around the town as a retiree. So this could be part of your package, letting out your room. So you let out your room and say, hey, we'll also take you around the city. We'll take you mountain biking. We'll teach you how to cook. This is a great way for people to bring in additional income as a retired. And it keeps you thinking. It keeps you engaged. It keeps you social. And these are the things that allow us to live longer, is when we're thinking and when we're social and we build environments. And then, of course, the income is a nice plus.
Well, one of the other big things we've seen a rise in since we last spoke to you is the rise of robo-investors. And I saw that you were tweeting about Sawa here in the UAE. We've had them on the show when they were part, actually, of the DIFC incubator, the Hive incubator. What do you make of the rise of robo-investors?
I think it's the future, because the beautiful thing about a robo-advisor is they'll build you a portfolio such as what I was talking about earlier. So you would have a globally diversified portfolio of exchange-traded index funds that you could tailor towards your specific risk tolerance. And so, of course, a young person would have higher component of equities or stock market exposure, and then an older person or a more conservative investor perhaps have a higher component of bonds, maybe a 50-50 split between stocks and bonds. But the beauty of them is that their fees are far lower than traditional investment firms. So that's the beauty. The less you pay in fees, the more money you'll make. But on the flip side, not so much the flip side, but to complement that, is the fact that they control your emotions. They will rebalance the portfolio on an annual basis, not based on forecasts, not based on speculation, but much like a college endowment fund would be rebalanced once a year.
Andrew, every time you've been here, I think every time you've been here, you've been giving seminars out, and they've sort of sold to, not sold because they're free, but standing room only at your seminars. You're not actually giving one this trip because you're actually leaving later on today. When are you back, and when will your next seminar actually be?
I'll be back in, I believe, September or October. So I have a series of talks that I'm doing in Asia. So I'm already scheduled to do those. There's a company here in Dubai that has asked me to come speak to their employers, to their employees in I think it's mid-September. So I'll be back in the area then, and perhaps open it up and, with some luck, give another public talk, another free public talk, speak at some schools and speak at some businesses as well.
And of course, you've got your books that outline what you do, Millionaire Teacher and Millionaire Expat. One of them, I know, is, I mean, you had a book out last year, didn't you? So at the beginning of this year, so fairly recently. Are you writing another?
No, at this stage I'm not. But the nice thing about Millionaire Expat is that I'm updating it. And so I'm able to go through it and every 6 months or so tweak things, try to improve it, clarity of ideas, that sort of thing. Many people will think that you've got to stay on top of things like the markets or the market news. My philosophy is that you really don't, that investing is far simpler than that. And if you try and stay on top of the markets and move your money accordingly, as we come back to that bar of soap analogy, it's just going to hurt you.
Andrew Hillam, expat investment expert and author. It's lovely to have you in the studio. Thanks for joining us on your trip here.
Thank you.
Hasta la vista, muchacho. Enjoy Mexico.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.